Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Glory and the Sorrow, A Parisian and His World in the Age of the French Revolution, by Timothy Tackett. Narrated by Derek Perkins. Publisher's note: this audiobook may refer to visual elements included in the print and e-book editions of the book. Prologue. In the drizzle and gloom of the early summer of 1797, Adrien Joseph Colson lay dying in his upstairs apartment in the centre of Paris. For decades, he had been something of a fixture on his street. Neighbours could always spot him, the elderly lawyer, a confirmed bachelor, walking about in his powdered wig and three-cornered hat, his colourful waistcoat, knee breeches, and white stockings, his Swiss pocket watch and copper-knobbed cane, or green umbrella in inclement weather. Even though most citizens in this generally working-class neighbourhood had ceased presenting themselves in such dress during the great revolution that had swept across France since 1789, and even though he spoke like someone who had spent time in school, a bourgeois of sorts, no one had ever suspected him of being a counter-revolutionary. He had always been a good patriot, attending the meetings of his neighbourhood section and even marching with the local National Guard despite his age. And he had always been kindly, never condescending, stopping to chat with those he encountered in the street, whatever their professions, forever curious, forever interested in what his neighbours thought or imagined of the astonishing series of events they were all experiencing. But now one of the priests, who had only recently been allowed by the government to return to his pastoral activities, had been seen entering Colson's building, carrying the Eucharist and the holy oils of extreme unction to administer the last rites. People guessed that the dizzy spells Colson had complained of over the past few years had not gone away this time. In any event, the onset of his illness must have been relatively sudden. According to the two young women who lived just below him, his most recent laundry package still lay unopened in his room beside the bed. Colson's landlord, the candlemaker, Jean-Louis Ladoubet, from whom he had rented his apartment for over 20 years, had brought in two elderly widows to care for his needs day and night during his sickness, and it was Ladoubet who would soon take charge of Colson's funeral. Perhaps those who knew him best, like Monsieur Ladoubet or the café owner Salmon, who lived across the street, and with whom he often chatted while he ate his meals, may have wondered what was passing through Colson's mind as he lay sick in his apartment. Surely he must have reflected on the halcyon days of the early revolution, when the whole world seemed to be changing, on the intense feelings of equality and brotherhood, and on the emergence of a politics of self-determination that would have been quite unimaginable only a few years earlier. How could he, how could any of them, forget the great decree of August 4, 1789, abolishing feudalism in France, or the stunning Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen only a few weeks later, or the ensuing suppression of the nobility, the creation of the First French Republic, the abolition of slavery, and the considerable expansion of the rights of women? But as he lay dying, it must also have been difficult to forget the fear and terror that had accompanied that revolution from its earliest days. There were the successive dangers from invasions by foreign and counter-revolutionary armies, armies determined, so it was feared, to wreak havoc on Paris and on much of its population. Perhaps, above all, there were the ever-present rumours of threats from lurking aristocrats, ready to destroy everything they had struggled to achieve, fears that at times had utterly dominated their lives. And as Ladoubet and Salmon well knew, such emotions had been compounded after 1792 by the personal disappointment and sorrow that the events of the revolution had brought about in Colson's personal life, the collapse of the relationship with his principal employer and of the friendship of his closest friend, and the closing and destruction of the church he had so long attended. Under normal circumstances, after his death, and after the death of those who had known him, the life of Adrien Colson would soon have disappeared from memory. He never published, he never held office, he never had his portrait drawn, and his name can be found scarcely a dozen times in the official records of the period, in parish registers and the files of notaries and justices of the peace. Like the vast majority of those living in times past, his existence would essentially have been swallowed up by history and erased by the passage of time. Posterity would have known nothing of the passions and ambitions, the struggles and successes, the loves and animosities and tragedies that must inevitably have marked his passage on this earth. Nothing would have been known of his experiences in the great political upheavals through which he lived. Yet, as fate would have it, a testimony of Colson's life was almost miraculously preserved, a testimony embedded in over 1,000 letters penned by the lawyer to a friend, Roque Lemaigre, living in the province of Berry in central France. This long correspondence is particularly fascinating for a number of reasons. First, it paints a picture of the lives of the common people in Paris in the course of the Revolution. To be sure, Colson was hardly a man of the people. As a lawyer, making his living as a business agent and legal adviser for a noble family and a family of wine merchants, his literacy and his modest but relatively comfortable economic situation clearly distinguished him from the great mass of the city's inhabitants at the end of the 18th century. But in other respects, he might well be considered a kind of social intermediary. He resided in a small apartment in the midst of one of the poorest and most crowded neighbourhoods of Paris, in the central right bank, just north of the island of La Cité. It was a quarter that had long been abandoned by most of the Parisian elites, who had largely moved farther north and west to the newly developing areas beyond the Louvre or across the Seine to the upscale Saint-Germain district. Moreover, Colson himself, unlike the great majority of Parisian lawyers of his time, came from a family of artisans in a small country town. One often has the impression that he felt more at ease chatting with the shopkeepers and craftsmen in his neighbourhood than with the elites of his own class, with neighbours like the candlemaker, his wife and daughters, who lived just downstairs and who served, in many respects, as a surrogate family. At any rate, his letters provide a remarkable testimony of the rise of radicalism in central Paris, and of both the moments of intense enthusiasm and the periods of terrible anxiety and rumours that repeatedly swept through his quarter of the city. Second, Colson's testimony affords insight into the little-known relations of the old regime nobility with the commoner agents and stewards who looked after their affairs. Colson's descriptions of those relations reveal a complex mixture of deference and loyalty on the one hand, and frustration and irritation on the other. This would especially be the case during the Revolution, as Colson found himself struggling to resolve the dire economic difficulties encountered by the noble family he served after the abolition of feudalism, and as he struggled, more generally, to distinguish good patriotic nobles from conspiring aristocrats. Third, the letters are revealing of the experience of a relatively elderly citizen at the time of the Revolution. It has often been said that revolutions are primarily an affair of the young, and indeed the average age of all the commoner deputies in the First National Assembly was only about 45, and that of the most prominent speakers was significantly less. Among the best-known revolutionary leaders, Mirabeau was 40 in 1789, Jacques Brissot was 35, Maximilien Robespierre was 31, Georges Danton was 30, and Antoine Barnave was only 28. Yet the case of Adrien Colson, 62 years old at the beginning of the Revolution, provides ample proof that even an older citizen could passionately follow and sometimes participate in the spectacular changes transpiring in Paris and Versailles during the last decade of the 18th century. The story of this ordinary citizen, in extraordinary times, as it is revealed in his correspondence and in a certain number of other documents, invariably falls into two parts. The first part, chapters 1 to 4, follows Colson's itinerary, from his birth in a small town on the border of the Austrian lowlands to his life and career in Paris at the end of the old regime. It focuses on the neighbourhood where he lived, his day-to-day activities, his professional life and relationship with the noble family he represented, and what can be discerned of his culture, his manner of ordering and understanding the world. The second part, chapters 5 to 9, traces Colson's experience from the eve of the revolution itself through his death in 1797, and the way in which daily life for him and his neighbours was transformed by events. Among the major themes to be explored are how, in fact, he came to embrace the new revolutionary values, how he became more radical in his views over time, the fear and rumours that continually swirled through his neighbourhood and necessarily marked his opinions and those of his neighbours, and his ultimate disenchantment with many aspects of the changes through which he lived. For well over 200 years, historians have struggled to understand the French Revolution, its origins, its development over time, its embrace of a political culture of violence, and how it came to an end. Obviously, the biography of this one individual cannot answer all of these questions, although it does provide new insights into many. Yet, Colson's rich and always thoughtful correspondence can reveal a great deal of what it was like to experience, to struggle to understand, and ultimately to participate in this world-transforming event. 1. Arrival in Paris. Perhaps, as Colson lay sick in his room in 1797, he may also have thought back almost half a century to the day he first entered the gates of Paris. For a young man of 23, who had known only the small towns of eastern France, the sounds and colours and odours, the extraordinary bustle, the unimaginable expanse of the city, must have seemed quite overwhelming. His hometown of Varennes-en-Argonne could claim only about 1,000 people clustered around a single main street and a small town square, surrounded by farmland and forests. But the capital of France, in the mid-18th century, already contained over 600,000 souls, making it the second-largest city in Europe after London, and one of the larger metropolises in the world at that time. As Colson soon came to realise, it was a city of great extremes. There were the monumental palaces of the Louvre and the Tuileries and the Luxembourg, and the townhouses that often resembled small palaces of some of the wealthiest aristocrats in Europe. There was the magnificent Gothic Cathedral of Notre-Dame on the central island of La Cité, the historic core of Roman Paris, along with dozens of churches and chapels, large and small, some even older than Notre-Dame, scattered across the city. There were the impressive Renaissance structures of the City Hall and many segments of the Palace of Justice. There were the grandiose open spaces created by a succession of Bourbon kings, the Place Louis le Grand, today's Place Vendôme, the Place Louis XV, Place de la Concorde, the Champs-Élysées to the west, and the Place Royale, Place des Vosges, to the east. And there was a whole line of bridges crossing the Seine, most with narrow shops and houses squeezed precariously along the two sides. He must also have been impressed by the great number of barges moving up and down the River Seine, or anchored along its banks, unloading cargoes of all kinds, some from France itself, some from elsewhere in Europe or from beyond the seas, all for the provisioning of the city. As Colson also soon learned, however, from the experience of the neighbourhood where he would take up residence, much of the city was still dominated by a labyrinth of narrow lanes and alleys, dark, dirty, smelly, and often unpaved, of small cluttered courtyards, and poor and somewhat dilapidated 3 to 5 storey structures with tiny shops at street level. It was a far cry indeed from the Paris of the late 19th century. The City of Lights, with its broad, tree-lined boulevards, sidewalk cafes and department stores, would emerge only after Paris had been massively rebuilt a century later by Napoleon III and Baron Haussmann. Within this extraordinary metropolis, Colson would soon come across an amazing mixture of some of the wealthiest and some of the most humble inhabitants in the entire French kingdom. He would have daily encountered great lords and ladies rushing about in their elegant carriages, soberly dressed merchants and professional people going about their business, nuns and clergymen in their diverse clerical garb, off-duty soldiers hanging out in cabarets or houses of ill repute, artisans and shopkeepers at work in their small shops, and a whole variety of street peddlers, market women, water carriers and rag pickers, not to mention prostitutes, pickpockets, thieves, and diverse ne'er-do-wells. Although most of the population adhered to the Catholic faith, there was also a scattering of Protestants and Jews. Amid this great mass of humanity, Colson would have joined the large numbers of young men and women streaming into the capital in the 18th century from all over France, and even from several neighbouring countries, with myriad accents and styles of dress, all searching for work and more hopeful futures. By certain estimates, some 10,000 new faces appeared in the city each year. Most of the migrants arrived from northern France, from a broad swath of provinces from Normandy to Lorraine. But others came from farther afield, bringing with them the customs and languages of Provence and Languedoc in the south, of Brittany in the far west, of Alsace to the east. Perhaps the largest group of new arrivals consisted of those looking for positions as servants. Wealthy households in the 18th century might have dozens of women and men in domestic service, and even more modest middle-class families could have one or two. Thousands more of the immigrants, a great many of them from Auvergne and Limousin in central France, were drawn to the capital by work in the building trades for a city in full expansion. Indeed, in the course of the century, Paris was bursting beyond its medieval and 17th century walls, as whole new neighbourhoods were created, especially in the west, where the wealthy classes were building residences. As the 18th century progressed, an impressive number of the better educated joined an overabundant population of hopeful young writers, with visions of demonstrating their genius and of embracing the goals of the Enlightenment, the great reform movement of the 18th century, and of becoming new Voltaires or Diderots or Rousseaus. Many, unfortunately, would only be able to scrape by with degrading jobs writing pornography or serving as police spies, gutter Rousseaus, as they were called in the 19th century. There was also a growing surplus of those trained in the law. In the late 18th century, well-educated young men who might once have gone into the clergy seem increasingly to have opted for legal careers. A certain number, like the future revolutionaries Camille Desmoulins and Jacques Brissot, might also have hoped to carve out careers as writers. In this respect, Colson was no doubt fortunate to have arrived at mid-century, a decade or two before the great influx of unemployed or underemployed lawyers. Indeed, Colson's career was all the more unlikely in that he originated in a family of artisans, while the vast majority of lawyers in Paris came from milieus of middle-class professionals or even from the nobility. He was born in 1727, the son of another Adrien Colson, a tanner in Varennes, in the northeast corner of France, not far from Luxembourg and what were then the Austrian lowlands, and would later become the sovereign state of Belgium. It was a frontier zone, not only politically, but also in terms of both language and religion. Although the population of Varennes and the immediate region had long spoken French, the German-speaking zone of Lorraine was not far away. During both the French Wars of Religion of the 16th century and the Thirty Years' War in the 17th century, the town, protected within its walls, had remained securely Catholic, even as Protestant armies ravaged the nearby countryside. It was only in 1659 that Varennes and the region of the Clermontais, in which it was located, had come permanently into the French sphere of influence, with Paris as its political and cultural focal point. Yet the frontier mentality may well have affected Colson, as seen both in his strong adherence to Catholicism and in his feelings of French identity, frequently indicated in his correspondence well before the French Revolution. Colson had been one of nine siblings born to his father and his mother, Marie Malot, six coming before him and two after. Sadly, however, all of his brothers and sisters had died either in infancy or in early childhood. Such a frightful mortality rate was not altogether unusual in old regime France, a hecatomb of babies and small children swept away by disease, sometimes aided by malnutrition that was even worse during the prolonged warfare and generally colder weather at the beginning of the 18th century. Whatever the realities described by demographers in abstract charts and graphs, it would be callous to think that women and men ever entirely overcame the loss of these little beings they hardly knew, and whom they could only send off to heaven with prayers for their souls. And for Colson, the ever-present reality of death had struck home even more tragically after his mother died worn out at age 51, when the future lawyer was just 12, leaving him an only child, living with his father. Thereafter, the father never remarried, and one must think he was probably too elderly to have had anything but a platonic relationship with Barbe Bizot, the middle-aged woman who cared for the family and kept house after the mother's death. In any case, it is little wonder that for the rest of his life, Colson, like so many others of his age, would remain obsessed with illness and death. Yet, as a result of the tragedies of his family life, Colson now found himself the sole heir to what was clearly an upwardly mobile family. His grandfather had been a simple shoemaker in a nearby village. His father, with the help of a judiciously chosen wife and the accompanying dowry, had been able to set himself up as a tanner, an occupation normally indicative of an income somewhat above the average for a minor town like Varennes. Indeed, at the time of his death, the father had begun calling himself a merchant tanner, and he had been able to acquire several pieces of land in the area, and a three-story house in the central town, directly across from the parish church. Yet the cultural milieu of the family remained that of the small-town artisan. In his youth, Adrien Joseph must have spent time helping his father in the tanning works just outside of town, and perhaps also checking up on the family's farms, an experience that would invariably have helped him later in life, when he oversaw the lands of a noble family. In reality, town and country were much closer and more tightly interconnected before the age of industrialization. Both parents and grandparents had lived through the grim days of the final wars of Louis XIV, especially difficult for a small community near the frontier with territory controlled by Austria, the archenemy of France. The young Colson would have been raised with tales of the ever-present threat of foreign invasion from across the border just 40 kilometres away, and of the burden of dealing with unruly French soldiers billeted in their homes or in barracks constructed in the town in the early 18th century. The fear of being overrun by German-speaking invaders was constantly in the minds of the inhabitants of Varennes under the old regime, as it would continue to be during the French Revolution. Perhaps such memories help us understand Colson's frequent references to war at home and abroad in his correspondence, and his personal alarm when it seemed as though Paris might be invaded by German troops in July 1789, and again in the summer of 1792 and the spring of 1793. Nevertheless, for certain elements of the population of his town, war could also have had its benefits. The soldiers, stationed in and around the valley of the Aire, where the town was situated, were in constant need of boots and leather goods for themselves and their horses, requirements that had undoubtedly contributed to the incomes of both his grandfather and his father. Colson never wrote in his correspondence about his early years in Varennes or his education. As was so often the case under the old regime, it had probably been the parish priest, who resided just across the square, who had first recognized his intelligence and potential in the catechism classes, and who had urged the father to promote his son's education. Thereafter, the younger Colson would have followed the classical curriculum that had dominated in France and in much of Europe since the 16th century, based on a rigorous knowledge of Latin and the Latin classics. He most likely followed the full course of secondary studies available in Varennes' Régence Latine, and through the more advanced teaching of the Cordeliers friars living nearby. Whether or not Colson's father ever hoped to turn his tanning business over to his only son, he had been persuaded that Adrien Joseph might aspire to something higher in society. The records have unfortunately been lost, but circumstantial evidence suggests that the higher in question may initially have been an ecclesiastical career, and that Colson spent time in the lower orders of the clergy from the end of his secondary studies to the age of 23. As we shall see, Colson would reveal signs of strong Catholic piety throughout his years in Paris, under both the old regime and the Revolution, and his personal library would contain religious books of considerable sophistication, beyond the simple works of piety and devotion found in many other households. Moreover, his age, 23, on his arrival in Paris, would have been relatively late for him to have begun clerking for a notary or an attorney. But it was precisely the age at which an aspiring cleric would have ascended to the order of the subdeaconate, generally considered the point of no return for a career in the clergy. At some point, he must have concluded that he did not have a sufficient vocation for such a career. In any case, he was ultimately able to convince his father that he could make what was always a huge step upward within the value system of the old regime, from the manual occupation of an artisan family into the professional class, and should thus begin preparation for the law. Father and son would have known many of the legal families concentrated in Varennes, the capital of the Clermontais district, with some 50 magistrates, barristers, clerks, and notaries serving the valley of the Aire. A few of these men may even have been distant relatives of Colson through his mother and grandmother. With no other sons to support or dowries for daughters to put aside, it was possible to concentrate all of the father's disposable revenues on Adrien Joseph's education and preparation for a law career. So it was that Colson had arrived in Paris in 1750, taking up residence on the Rue Bertin-Poiré on the right bank of the Seine. This first apartment was close to the principal centres of legal activity at the Châtelet, half a kilometre up the Seine, and at the Palace of Justice on the island of La Cité, just across a branch of the river, two courthouses Colson would come to know so well throughout his career. During the early 1750s, he would have spent a period of apprenticeship as a clerk in the office of an established notary or barrister, while also attending court proceedings in the Parliament of Paris or the Bailliage Court in the Châtelet. He was proud of these years and of the training they had afforded him, which he considered far more important than a formal legal education. University studies, as he would write many years later, led to nothing more than learning definitions by heart, and it was only through actual experience in law offices and attendance in courts that one could learn the profession in all its details. Nevertheless, a formal university degree did carry an element of prestige, necessary for finding a better position or going it alone as a lawyer. And in 1755-56, he was registered in the University of Reims, about 130 kilometres east of Paris, a law school notorious for the ease with which it granted degrees. There he obtained the diploma of licence et loi that would permit him, in principle, to practice law anywhere in the realm. The degree would also allow him to earn the coveted designation of avocat en parlement, a lawyer with the right to plead in the Parlement of Paris, the single most important court of law in France. Sometime after 1756, having completed his apprenticeship and obtained his diploma, Colson travelled back to Varennes. About this time he must have announced to his father that he would not be taking up a law career in his hometown, since he had been offered a rather exceptional position in Paris as the legal and financial agent for a noble family living there, and that he would not be returning for several years. Did the father and the son feel a sense of grief at the parting? Unfortunately, one will never know. Given the father's great age, 85 years old at the time, and of his long-standing infirmities, everyone suspected that he might soon pass away. Indeed, the younger Colson drew up a power of attorney in favour of a family friend to handle all their affairs in case of his father's death. Then, in late 1758, Adrien Joseph Colson, aged 31, departed from Varennes for Paris, never to see his father again. By the time Colson Sr. died in the spring of 1759, his son had already been gone from his hometown for some 8 months, and was beginning to build a new life for himself in central Paris. 2. Life in Paris before the Revolution. Once re-established in the capital, and after one or two initial moves, Colson took up permanent residence in a small apartment on the Rue des Arcis, which he sublet from the master candlemaker, Ladoubé, who lived and worked there with his wife and two adult daughters. The street no longer exists, except for a small portion attached to the bottom of the Rue Saint-Martin, while the building itself disappeared in the 19th century when the broad Rue de Rivoli was pushed through the neighbourhood. Colson's residence took up the entire second floor of the five-story building, a three-room L-shaped apartment, wrapped around a common stairwell, with a sitting room, an office of sorts, and a bedroom, and with exposed wooden beams in the ceilings throughout. The privy, outside by the stairwell, held a pot and a seat shared by others living above in the building. The pot would have been emptied each night, when the contents were carried away in the night soil carts, thus sharing its distinctive aromas with much of the building. But
sample complete. Ready to continue?